I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's October 20th, and we have a lot to talk about. Back in March, which truly seems like a lifetime ago, one of my guests was Dawnia Baines, and Dawnia facilitates an MS support group for teens. The National MS Society estimates that there are about 5,000 children and teens living with MS in the United States, and since Dawnia joined me, I've received a number of listener requests for more information about pediatric MS. So first up today, we're going to hear from one of the teens who participates in Dawnia's MS support group, when I'll be joined by Hannah Schnitzler and her mom, Melissa Fisher. And after my conversation with Hannah and Melissa, we'll take a deeper dive into pediatric MS with my special guest, Dr. Brenda Banwell, the chief of the Division of Neurology at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and a renowned specialist in pediatric MS. But before we get to my conversations with Hannah, Melissa, and Dr. Banwell, there are a few other things that you should know about. N-acetylglucosamine is a natural simple sugar that's found in breast milk and commercially sold as an over-the-counter dietary supplement to manage joint pain, inflammatory bowel disease, and to prevent heart attack and stroke. Now, there's not much in the way of clinical evidence that shows that it actually does any of these things. But newly published study results show that it also prevents myelin degeneration and loss of motor function in the mouse model of MS. The researchers found that N-acetylglucosamine activates myelin-producing cells and promotes myelin repair. Once the research team observed how this simple sugar impacted mice with the mouse version of MS, they assessed 180 people living with MS and found that those MS patients with low levels of N-acetylglucosamine had significantly greater myelin and nerve fiber damage, raising the possibility that N-acetylglucosamine deficiency may contribute to disease severity in MS. Representing another avenue requiring further research, it's also worth noting that N-acetylglucosamine is a major component of human breast milk, but not baby formula. So with my usual disclaimers that there's a big difference between a mouse brain and a human brain, and lots more research is still required here, this is an interesting development that's worth following. If you'd like to review the study results, I'll include a link in today's show notes. A research team at the Pritzker School of Molecular Engineering at the University of Chicago has designed a new therapy for MS that has been shown to suppress MS symptoms and even prevent MS from developing in the mouse model of MS. So, first, let me tell you what I mean when I say they've designed a new therapy. Let's start with a little background. Cytokines are a category of signaling molecules that, among other things, mediate and regulate inflammation in the central nervous system. And a particular anti-inflammatory cytokine, called interleukin-4, is known to suppress the genes that cause MS and suppress cells that infiltrate the central nervous system and cause damage in people with MS. Now, the challenge to the research team was how to keep these cytokines in the right place, where they could continue to suppress these potentially damaging cells and keep them from acting out. The team solved that challenge by binding this cytokine to a blood protein. The research team injected their newly designed therapy into mice with the mouse model of MS, and they observed that fewer of these damaging cells could infiltrate the spinal cord, and that resulted in fewer MS symptoms for the mice. And they found that in the majority of these mice, this therapy prevented MS from even developing. The new therapy showed few side effects, but this is extremely early stage science. Next, The team needs to understand any potential toxicity associated with this new treatment, and then they can begin a phase 1 clinical trial with humans. So this is also really encouraging news, and all my disclaimers about the differences between a mouse brain and a human brain are still in effect. Now, if you'd like to read more about this study, I'll include a link in today's show notes. There's positive news this week about the availability of disease-modifying therapies in the United Kingdom. In a reversal of their previous guidance, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence issued a new guidance approving Mayzent as a treatment for people living with active secondary progressive MS in England and Wales. This positive guidance follows the finalization of a confidential agreement between Novartis, the manufacturer of Mayzent, and the UK's National Health Service. This agreement will make Mayzent available to patients at a discounted price. And in the same week, the Scottish Medicines Consortium also approved Mayzent as a treatment for active secondary progressive MS, making Mayzent the first oral disease-modifying therapy approved for treating secondary progressive MS in England, Wales, and Scotland. Mayzent has already been approved in the US, the European Union, Australia, and Canada. We talk a lot about research on Real Talk MS because I believe that research is the engine that powers the future. Research is the thing that creates brighter tomorrows. And if you're someone who's affected by MS, research is the thing that can be life-changing. But research doesn't happen in a vacuum. It takes participation. And if you're interested in being contacted about MS research opportunities that you may participate in, then one of the things that I'll recommend is completing the online survey at the University of Washington's Multiple Sclerosis Rehabilitation and Wellness Center. While some of their studies require that you be available to travel to Seattle, Washington, most of them are conducted entirely online or over the phone. And completing this survey and providing your information does not mean that you're agreeing to join a research study. It means that they might contact you and invite you to join a study that you may be a good fit for. So I hope you'll consider completing this survey and maybe having a hand in creating the future. I'll include a link to the University of Washington Multiple Sclerosis Rehabilitation and Wellness Center's Research Participant Survey in today's show notes. While we're on the subject of surveys, if you're the parent of a child or teen who's living with pediatric MS, a research team is recruiting participants for an online survey that's designed to explore the experiences in and barriers to accessing mental health services for parents who are caring for children under the age of 18 with MS and other chronic medical conditions. The survey is anonymous. It's mostly multiple choice questions, and it will take you somewhere between 10 and 20 minutes to complete. The survey is available online in both English and Spanish, and I'll include links to both the English and Spanish surveys in today's show notes. Living with MS can be emotionally challenging. And when it's your child who's been diagnosed with MS? Well, I think the idea that some parents may require emotional support from a professional probably makes a lot of sense. But in a moment, we're going to meet a teen who's living with MS and with an incredibly resilient spirit, and we'll also meet her mom, who sounds much the same way. In a moment, we'll meet my guests, Hannah Schnitzler and Melissa Fisher. I always remind folks that MS affects families and not just individuals, and that's probably most clear when we're talking about pediatric MS. The National MS Society estimates that there are fewer than 5,000 diagnosed cases of pediatric MS in the United States and less than 10,000 cases worldwide. But those numbers become far less important when you're one of those diagnosed cases. My guests today are Hannah Schnitzler and her mom, Melissa Fisher. Welcome to the podcast, ladies.
Thanks, John. We appreciate you having us.
Hannah, tell me, how old are you now, and how old were you when you were diagnosed with MS?
I'm 18 right now, and I was diagnosed when I was 15, turning 16.
And what were the initial symptoms that led to your diagnosis?
My first symptom that caught my attention was the numbness in my legs, which ended up lasting for about 2 months. It was mainly that which caused me to like go get it checked out and everything, and then which led to the diagnosis.
And how did you feel when you received your MS diagnosis?
I was really confused because I had no idea as to what it was. My one friend actually told me that maybe it could be MS when I was trying to figure it all out, but I Googled it and I kind of thought that I wouldn't be able to have that because I was so young. But then obviously I was diagnosed with it, so it kind of caught me off guard.
And Melissa, how did you feel when Hannah was diagnosed? What was that experience like for you?
I think I agree with Hannah. In the beginning, I didn't really want to think that that's what it could be. There was a lot of fear. I have had a close friend who was diagnosed probably about 20 years ago. And 20 years ago, what MS looks like, it looks a lot different now, right? MS Society has so much with the fundraising and the advancements. And, so there was a lot of fear, but I kind of thought, well, if this is what it is, the best thing for us to do is go somewhere for treatment for Hannah that, where they're current with the technology, studies, clinical trials, and really immerse ourselves in as much education for both of us, because for her as the patient and for me as the parent, and trying to determine how I could best support her. But it was really scary in the beginning. And then it's kind of sad, because you don't want your child to have an illness or, be diagnosed with something that could affect them throughout their lifetime.
So, Hannah, you were diagnosed when you were in high school. Did you feel like MS got in the way of high school life?
In certain aspects, I would say it did get in the way. During my junior year of high school, I went full fiber because with all of the hospital visits, I was missing classes and I was getting behind. So I kind of thought to myself, maybe I should just do it all from home because it would be easier for me. With the social aspect, it didn't really change much. I was still with my friends and everything. But my senior year of high school, I went back to the public school because I missed my friends and I wanted to have like my normal aspect of high school back again because cyber school wasn't the same as regular public school for me.
I think that's something that an awful lot of people are discovering for themselves right now, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
What about you, Melissa? Did you see MS having an impact at home?
Not so much. Hannah is a very calm young woman. And just took everything with stride. She just seemed to take in the information. And I guess for some, I don't know, I was a little worried because I thought, well, if there's something going on, is she going to be able to tell me? Is she going to talk to me about it? And just kind of keeping the communication open, saying, hey, I'm here. I'm going to do whatever I can to support you. No, we don't know what this is going to look like, but we're going to get as much information as we can and try and make good decisions. Because I wanted Hannah's the one who decided what medication route to go. She picked the medication that she felt most comfortable with for her treatment, which, that empowering her to make good decisions, for because it is her life, it's her body. But I don't know that we had so many direct, it didn't impact the family. There was a lot of time spent going between, we live probably about an hour with traffic, hour and a half from the hospital where we go. So there was a lot, like long days, long doctor's visits, MRIs, things of that nature. But besides that, we really were surrounded by a lot of great, amazing people who gave us information and really helped us navigate everything.
So a second ago, Hannah, I mentioned that obviously you were diagnosed while you were still in high school, but tell me, what are you doing now?
As of right now, I'm going to college. I'm enrolled at DeSales and I'm studying psychology. With COVID and everything, the classes tend to be online and then in person, then back online, very back and forth. But I'm still continuing my plan prior to getting diagnosed, like going to college and everything. So it hasn't set me back in regards to that situation.
So are you away at school or do you commute from home?
I commute. It's only about 15, 20 minutes from home.
I was going to say COVID aside, but it really is like the most massive interruption we've all had to deal with in life. But how's everything going at college so far?
So far, everything's going good. There is, the workload is very different compared to high school, but I think I'm getting the hang of everything so far. And I'm communicating with my professors about the workload again, and then the diagnosis itself, considering I have to go to the hospital like momentarily, and I want them to be aware of unexpected situations that I have no say in. So I'm like communicating as much as possible just to let them know.
You know, I think you and I have a friend in common. She was actually a guest on the podcast back in March, and one of the things we talked about then was the support group for teens living with MS that she facilitates. Of course, I'm talking about Dawnea Baines, and I'm interested in hearing your thoughts about what participating in a support group does for you.
It's like, it's been amazing so far, because if I don't want to speak with friends about my MS or my family, which I never don't want to do, but if they're busy with their own stuff going on, then I can always go to like the group chat that I have with my support group. We always have projects to do when it comes to when it comes to spreading awareness. We always have like videos, and we try to do as much as we can to spread awareness, because we want other people to know that it's not just people over the age of 20 getting diagnosed who have MS, who's also teenagers. So like 18 and lower, it's insane that there are such young kids getting MS like me and other people. So we want to reach out to people that are also of the same age and even older, so they know that they aren't alone when it comes to having MS.
Well, I'm going to ask you and your mom the same question, and I'll start with you, Hannah. If you met somebody today who was 15 going on 16 years old and they were just diagnosed with MS, what would you share with them?
I would tell them to try their best not to worry too much about it, because they're always going to have somewhere to go when they need to be comforted, whether that be their family or their doctor or the neurologist. And if they were aware of the MS Society, they would always have that to go to as well to get answers. They wouldn't be in the dark about it. And I feel like it's really important to know that, because when I was first diagnosed, I wasn't totally sure if I was going to have anybody. But over the course of maybe 2-3 months, I figured out that I wasn't alone, and it really helped me.
How about you, Melissa? If you met another mom whose teenage son or daughter was just diagnosed, what advice might you offer them?
Well, I first have to say, every time I hear Hannah talk about it, it kind of tears me up, because the way she's handled this is just, it blows me away. You know, sometimes you think, oh, I don't do a good job as a parent, and I watch how, you know, she's assimilated her life with this, and it's amazing, you know, and she should give herself credit for that. But I tell her parents, stay connected to people, get involved. We went to, an MS conference, and it was a great experience, connecting with other people and other parents. And, you know, I remember when we first got the results of the one MRI back, and the nurse practitioner from our pediatrician's office called. And she said, I'm a little concerned, this could be MS. And I said, oh, you must have a lot of patients. And she said, actually, we don't have any patients who have MS. And it was very daunting, because I thought, wow, you know, we live in a rural area, but it's a fairly large, small town. And there's a lot of people go to this pediatric practice. And when she said that to me, I thought, how is that even possible? You know, is it that people do have it and we just don't realize the symptoms, or it's brushed off, or the doctor doesn't dig deep enough? You know, luckily for us, you know, as a parent, I would say, make sure that you are advocating for what you believe your child needs and what you need. And if, you know, you're getting one opinion and something's still not sitting right, get a second opinion. Go to another doctor. Get more testing. Because we do know that the earlier we test, you know, the earlier we diagnose, the better, you know, treatment outcomes and things of that nature. And just be supportive and listen to your child, because they are going to need, and every kid's different, right? But, just showing up for your child and being that person who advocates for them and walks with them is really important. But the help is out there, and that's the beautiful thing.
Being diagnosed with MS can be scary, and being diagnosed with pediatric MS can feel even scarier. Chances are that the child or adolescent who's just been diagnosed doesn't know a single person with MS, so it's easy for their imagination to manufacture all kinds of frightening scenarios. I've always found that getting solid information is a great way to keep our imaginations in check. So, Hannah and Melissa, thanks for providing that kind of solid information by sharing your stories. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you for having us. We've been looking forward to speaking with you and, you know, wholeheartedly believe in the podcast and, you know, getting the word out there and, you know, helping everybody with MS, you know, to live a healthy life, stay connected.
In some ways, pediatric MS affects a child or adolescent in much the same way that MS affects an adult. But children aren't simply little adults. Every day, children and teens are literally learning how to be people. They endure social pressures and situations that most adults have successfully blocked out of our own memories. So, what things are the same and what things are different when it comes to treating a child or teen who's living with pediatric MS? In a moment, we'll find out when we meet my guest, Dr. Brenda Banwell. And I'll offer up some apologies ahead of time. There are about three instances during my interview with Dr. Banwell where it's going to be difficult to hear everything that Dr. Banwell is saying. These moments are short, really just a couple of seconds each, but I know that they're a distraction and an interruption. I think Dr. Banwell has so much valuable information to share that it's worth plowing through those couple of rough spots, so I've left them in. In a moment, we'll hear my conversation with Dr. Brenda Banwell. Dr. Brenda Banwell is the chief of the Division of Neurology at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and the holder of the Grace R. Loeb Endowed Chair in Neurosciences. Dr. Banwell specializes in pediatric MS and other neuroimmune disorders. She's authored more than 250 manuscripts that have been published in peer-reviewed journals, as well as over 25 book chapters. Dr. Banwell advocates for pediatric multiple sclerosis needs and research as the chair of the International Pediatric Multiple Sclerosis Study Group and as director of the International Medical and Scientific Advisory Board of the Multiple Sclerosis International Federation. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Banwell.
Thank you, and I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, I guess a good place to start is a pretty basic question. Is MS in children different than MS in adults?
So in general, no, but I'll make a few clarifying statements to that answer. Pediatric onset multiple sclerosis is essentially uniformly relapsing remitting at onset, whereas, of course, 20% or so of adult onset MS patients experience primary progressive disease. That primary progressive phenotype or primary progressive disease expression is not a pediatric manifestation of MS. So that clarification is important. When you then look at relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis and compare the clinical features, disease course, and imaging of children to relapsing remitting patients in the adult world, they're really overall quite similar. The attacks are similar. Children recover quite well from an individual relapse, maybe a little bit better than adults do on average. But children tend to have a fairly high relapse frequency, so they tend to look a lot more like young adults with relapsing remitting MS.
We know that MS is more common in women than men. I'm wondering, is it also more common in girls than boys?
Yes. Once you get into the teenage years, the ratio of girls to boys is about 3-1. Overall, definitely more girls than boys.
Do adults who were originally diagnosed with pediatric MS when they were children or teens, do they have a different disease course as adults than adults who were diagnosed with MS when they were already adults?
To the best of our knowledge, the disease course of patients with pediatric onset multiple sclerosis carries onward into the adult age span as pretty similar to adults. on adult onset disease. In that, it's relapsing remitting with a risk for secondary progressive disease later in life. I think the older data pre-current therapy indicated that the time from first attack to secondary progressive multiple sclerosis in pediatric onset patients took about 20 years, whereas in adult onset relapsing remitting MS, entry into secondary progressive disease was about 10 years from disease onset. However, when you look at the actual age, pediatric MS patients were younger because 20 years after starting when you were 10 places you only at age 30. Whereas, of course, in our adult onset, relapsing remitting MS patients, entry into secondary disease progression might be at age 45 or 50. I am sincerely hoping that everything I just said is now largely changed by highly effective MS therapies, but we don't have 15 or 20 years yet of observation of pediatric MS patients treated with those highly effective therapies to know whether the risk of secondary progressive disease has now been reduced.
That is really interesting. So this is something that you're kind of learning and observing in real time almost.
We absolutely are. Yes. When we started the pediatric MS program in Toronto in 1999, which is where I was at the time, you know, the entire literature in pediatric onset MS took me less than a day to read. And there was a single case report of treatment using an interferon in an 8-year-old. That was it. So there's been a great deal of increased awareness about pediatric onset MS. You know, we had to overcome the idea that it never occurred. We had to then define criteria. We then, you know, as a community, have really pushed forward in recognition that pediatric onset MS is unfortunately a real disease that affects a much rarer population compared to adults, but certainly still thousands of children per year in the world. So, you know, when you put it in that context, we're really just now getting to 20 to 25 years of understanding this condition. And really only 15 years of detailed, high-quality, long-term cohorts that we can really understand the disease. So we're many years behind our adult-onset MS colleagues in terms of understanding our patient population.
You know, I've heard people just conversationally discuss pediatric MS, and very often one of the comments I will hear is, well, now we have pediatric MS. So just to clarify, is this a situation where pediatric MS has all of a sudden or fairly recently begun to occur? Or is this a situation where we have better diagnostic tools and now it's being diagnosed where it could have been overlooked or misdiagnosed in the past?
It is absolutely true that our ability to make the diagnosis and our awareness has driven probably the majority of the increased recognition. It's not clear because we don't yet have enough information whether the actual number of pediatric onset MS patients is increasing. That's always a hard thing to prove because as soon as you start becoming more aware and you have better criteria, more access to brain MRI scans, which are the, you know, the lion's share of the imaging that assists in the diagnosis of pediatric MS, you know, without all of that, we wouldn't be able to confirm the diagnosis and rule out other mimics of MS. So, you know, no question awareness has been probably the driving reason. And I can illustrate that briefly. We did a survey way back in the early 2000s of Canadian pediatricians. And it was part of a surveillance program in Canada where we queried 2,500 pediatric providers every month about whether they had seen a child with what might be the first attack of MS. And we before we started that, and it was a 3-year, you know, so 36 survey study. And before we started, I asked all of those 2,500 how many thought they had ever seen a pediatric MS patient. And it was 21% at the time we started the program. 3 years later, 88% said they now felt that at least at some point in the last year, they had identified an individual with pediatric onset MS. And we did not quadruple the incidence of MS in 3 years. What we did was quadruple awareness. So I think that is one illustration of the fact that it just wasn't in the repertoire of pediatricians to think about MS in children back in the early 2000s, whereas now most of my residents
well, all of them would be incredibly comfortable discussing pediatric onset MS, the differential, the MRI features, the laboratory features, and the management, which was not part of core pediatric training 20 years ago.
MS brings with it all sorts of psychosocial challenges, but children and teens are at a very different, a more critical developmental stage than adults. I mean, children and teens are literally learning how to be people as they grow up. What sort of an impact does layering an MS diagnosis on top of those more typical psychosocial challenges have on children and teens with MS?
Great question. I think and the answer is highly individualized and also relates very, very much to the support that the child and family receive. So I have the extreme of some of my particularly teenagers who are with me that they feel they're a better person because of their diagnosis, that they are more giving, more aware, value things differently, are stronger and more resilient. They obviously wish they didn't have the disease, but they feel like they're being effectively treated, that their relapses are under control, and that this process has made them and their family stronger. I have other patients who struggle from outset with the emotional burden of having a serious diagnosis, who struggle with depression, which affects about a third of pediatric onset MS patients, and importantly, a sizable percentage of teenagers who do not have MS. So it's a common age to experience emotional health crises. And families, in particular parents, who may themselves struggle more with their child's diagnosis than the child directly. We've looked at the quality of life of families who have a child with MS, and parents, particularly mothers, more because they tend to be the ones filling out the questionnaire potentially, but endorse that their personal self and quality of life has been reduced in worrying about the future of their son or daughter. So with appropriate and prompt emotional support for the family, with accurate knowledge, with pulling kids off Google where they look up MS and read about progressive disease in 50-year-olds and trying to get them to understand that they are living with a relapsing form of the disease in an era of therapies that are effective and well-tolerated, we can and do empower our patients to live with MS in a way that the majority feel they do well. But it is absolutely essential that whole experience and that every visit is accompanied by a careful appraisal of emotional and psychological well-being, that we have social workers, psychologists, and psychiatrists available for our patients and their families, and that we never let go of the importance of just the challenge of being a teenager and adding on the challenge of living with a serious diagnosis that their friends don't share.
Mentioning support, it occurred to me that if pediatric MS patients go through much the same sort of disease course as adults, some of what they have to deal with are maybe cognitive issues or MS-related fatigue. And if they're dealing with those sorts of things while they're being teenagers, does that typically require some sort of accommodation at school so they can just function well throughout the day?
So yes. So advocating for school accommodation is one of the more important things I think we do as pediatric neurologists looking after our pediatric onset MS patients. So first and foremost, we need the endorsement of the teenagers, typically the teenagers that have the cognitive impairment more visible, but younger children as well. You know, the last thing I want to do is start advocating for changes and accommodations in school with a teenager who's not yet ready to publicly disclose that they live with MS. So that dialogue and that support is important first. But then, working with the school, we like to do this by having a comprehensive neuropsychological evaluation so we know the strengths of our teenager living with MS, of how do they learn best, and where do they have some challenges. And I would say that about a third of my patients, I keep saying one third, but it really is about a third of my patients have some degree of cognitive impairment in particular domains, most commonly multitasking, what we call executive function, which broadly put is, ordering and thinking about how to do multiple things at once, and identifying priorities in their homework, and strategies for how to do their homework. So
we can work very effectively with schools to accommodate this. We try to reduce cognitive fatigue. So, you know, if there's a homework assignment that is 50 math questions, but yet, you know, if it's existing French, there's really only 20 that illustrate that the concept has been understood, then maybe an MS patient living with fatigue doesn't need to do 50 to demonstrate their knowledge base. You know, we make sure that kids have an adequate time to do their exams and to complete assignments, that teachers are sympathetic to the fact that they may have a tired day and that maybe that's not the day they can get everything done. And let's, you know, accommodate that they may need a little bit of extra time or more flexibility. I try very hard with the kids that are in the high school environment to make sure that they don't have exams on one day. I would argue that that would improve the performance of every high school student. But certainly we don't need every high school student with MS struggling with that kind of overburdened artificial pressure when they could have more accommodation and spread things out. So it really does help to have this 504 in place in the U.S. That's the term for an accommodation in school, which just makes sure that our patients aren't penalized simply because they're fatigued or because they have particular challenges that we can help them with. And then make sure that they perform maximally in school.
I know that adults living with relapsing remitting MS have more than 20 FDA-approved disease-modifying therapies to consider when they consider treatment. The FDA has approved one disease-modifying therapy for pediatric MS. That's Gilenya. Correct. Is that all that we need?
Mm-hmm. So definitely not. We live as pediatricians, broadly, we live in a world where most of the therapies that we prescribe are not technically FDA approved because there are far too few formal studies of any therapy in any disease in the pediatric age group. So we are advocates for access to effective therapy as a huge part of our job. We do have real world safety and tolerability data for many more than just one of the currently approved MS therapies. We have international consensus meetings to talk about how to safely dose and use therapies that are approved for adults in our pediatric population. And we are incredibly strong advocates for the need for more of these trials to be completed. Several are underway and several are just completing now of other therapies. We cannot leave pediatric MS patients in a situation where wonderful, new, effective therapies for the disease are not available to them. That being said, it does require advocacy and letters and discussions with insurance companies and discussions with medical directors of insurance companies to advocate for access to these therapies for pediatric patients. And it's certainly a major challenge.
Medical science tells us that there is some sort of genetic component to MS. It hasn't yet been well defined, but it's there. So I'm wondering, are there things that families where one or both parents have MS, or there may be MS somewhere in that family? Is there anything that parents should be paying attention to in assessing their children?
So a few things. So you're correct that there is an overrepresentation of MS within families relative to within a community. So if you have a first-degree relative living with MS, then your risk is higher than your next-door neighbor's. And in context, if you have a brother or sister with multiple sclerosis, your risk is lifetime, about 3 to 5%. Or flipping it around, you live with a 95 to 97% chance that you will never be diagnosed with MS, even if you have a brother or sister who has it. So there is some risk, but it is not a traditionally heritable disease where, you know, as we see in some conditions, where if your parent has the disease, you have a 50% chance of developing the disease or a 25%, depending on the type of inheritance pattern, et cetera. So there is a familial risk, but that risk runs in the sort of 3 to 5% for first degree relative range. So when we have that conversation with parents in terms of what should they consider doing with their other children to see if there's any way to reduce the likelihood that that their other children will develop MS. We talk about risk factors that have been identified for MS and how many of those can we influence. And there's several.
So low vitamin D levels have been linked to MS risk in a variety of studies. It is a national health recommendation that everyone take at least 1,000 units of vitamin D per day, because we live in a society that is wisely avoiding excessive sun. And unfortunately, in a society that eats relatively little in terms of vitamin D-enriched food, and even if you tried, getting enough vitamin D in milk, for example, or fish would require a consumption of those products higher than most people would tolerate. So a vitamin D supplement is something that's a national health recommendation just for human health anyway, and we advocate that our families adhere to that, and where possible, to even get their vitamin D circulating levels checked so we know if 1,000 units is enough for each of those individuals. Second thing is avoiding smoking. You know, both secondhand smoke in at least one study and direct smoking have been linked either with MS risk or with worse MS outcome or both. And it's certainly a strong health recommendation to avoid smoking at all costs. Obesity. There are several studies that have shown obesity in childhood or early adolescence is a risk factor for MS. So promoting healthy exercise and healthy weight, which are just good lifestyle health measures to take, may also reduce the risk both in a family who already have an individual living with MS, but in the community more broadly. So these are all common sense health recommendations that will promote the health and well-being of a person irrespective of their MS risk, but may be particularly important for individuals who have a higher than average lifetime risk of MS.
Dr. Brenda Banwell, thank you for all that you do to ensure that the most vulnerable group of MS patients can experience a very best childhood or teenage years. And thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with me today.
No, absolutely, my pleasure. My patients are amazing people to work with and get to know, so it's my pleasure to share with you the things that we've learned.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their browser at realtalkms.com/164. And you'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. I don't think that I have to tell anyone listening to this podcast that the COVID-19 pandemic has intensified and in some cases multiplied the challenges of living with MS. More than ever before, people living with MS need access to reliable information, support, and connection. We're witnessing that even during a global pandemic, MS doesn't stop, and neither does the National MS Society. With vital funding from supporters like you, the National MS Society is continuing to meet the urgent and expanding needs of the MS community during these unprecedented times, while ensuring that the MS research community rebounds quickly from COVID-19 so that the progress and momentum toward finding a cure continues. And that's why I hope that, as you're able, you'll make a donation to the Society's COVID-19 Response Fund. It couldn't be easier. Just text the word GIVE to 68686, and you'll get a link right to the MS Society's COVID-19 Response Fund webpage. I hope you'll consider contributing today, because it's never been more important. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.